your prime.
What about my prime, Nick?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at arguably the greatest movie ever made, Big Trouble in Little China. John Carpenter reunites with Kurt Russell to navigate the mystical San Francisco underworld that is full of martial artists, monsters, and mullets. Action-packed and full of laughs, this movie proves that it's all in the reflexes.
Folks, a bit of housekeeping. This week, I was unable to record because of travel obligations. That does not affect this week's podcast. It affects next week's podcast, because that is how these things work. Next week, I will re-air my conversation with Jean and Alicia about Coogler's Sinners, which Steve has yet to see. Then, the week after that, Steve and I will be back with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Make sure you're checking out everything that's happening with the Lorehounds, especially their coverage of Murderbot. All right, here is my conversation with Steve Osborne about Big Trouble in Little China. Steve, I feel like we need a tattoo update here. Most of your life, you had zero tattoos. Now, I think you have two. I could be wrong about that. And I want to know, how often have you flirted with a Big Trouble in Little China tattoo?
Often. So I have three tattoos. The Teen Wolf one, amongst the options provided to the artist, were Big Trouble in Little China options. And she had said that she had actually, because she does new school style, she says she really likes to do exaggerated heads and all that stuff. And she says she's done a Jack Burton in the past, but she says he has Haley Joel Osment features in terms of small features for a large head. So she says the head is a great option to tattoo, but then when you get to the face and the features, it feels very scrunched.
I didn't know that Haley Joel Osment was a type of face.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like, it even predates his birth. They were referring to it in encyclopedias.
So the first tattoo was almost a Jack Burton tattoo.
And then when I got the Ghostbusters one, I also gave options. And he's like, man, he was actually very excited to work with me because of the reference to Big Trouble in Little China. But he was having a hard time finding a reference he wanted to work with that had the crispness that he was looking for. But course, the Pork Chop Express logo has been kicked around, and it will happen. It's just a matter of if it needs to be a part of something larger.
Okay. All right. Now, do I know about the third tattoo?
Yeah, that's the Tootsie Pop Owl.
Ah, of course. Yeah. How many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop?
Yeah.
You've got that Tootsie Pop Owl. Where is this located?
Inner left bicep.
And the other two are on shoulders, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. So no Pork Chop Express tattoo yet.
Right. Yet is the appropriate word.
Okay. Last night, I watched Big Trouble in Little China for the first time all the way through. I thought I had seen this at least twice in my life. And it turns out I don't remember the beginning or the ending of this movie. I have very strong images of some of the fight sequences in this movie and some of the puppeteering in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it was my first time watching all the way through, and it was a family event. I think this is the first time I got my entire family, my wife, my son, who fell asleep 5 minutes in, my daughter and my daughter's girlfriend. We were all hanging out and watching this movie and really, really enjoying ourselves. And I pitched this to them as your favorite movie, but I don't know if that is actually
it's hard for me to say it isn't my favorite movie. The level of enjoyment that I get out of rewatching it, and I rewatch it a bunch, is, I don't know that there's, I mean, there are movies that I think are, you know, are fantastic, and I appreciate them. But this is that real nice balance of I can rewatch it, and every time I enjoy it a little bit more, and I like to do a little bit more research on it every time I watch it. It's, you know, came out in 1986, went and saw it at Empire Cinemas in Rohnert Park at 10 years old with my mother and my sister, and they absolutely hated it. And they were like, oh my gosh, that's like the worst movie I've ever seen. And I just looked at them and I'm like, I need a DNA test. Like, this is, I wanted to go back and watch it immediately. It's, and, you know, from a 10-year-old perspective, it's like, oh, it's got action, it's funny. I've been to San Francisco, you know, so there's like all, like, it was just wildly entertaining. And then the more I've watched it over the years, and like, so many people I know that like have an appreciation for it. And so it's like, it's fun to talk about. And but we even did it for a Big Flick Energy, which was going to be hard because I was like, I know why it's silly, so I can make some jokes and stuff. But like, I was surprised at how many people walked out of there going, ah, that movie's just terrible. I'm like, what's wrong with you?
It certainly is an acquired taste. I think, and to fully enjoy it, you have to know what the intention was going in. In fact, halfway through the film last night, Sarah was like, all right, pause it. I've got questions.
Yeah.
And this was sort of like, oh, good. I can't wait. I can't wait to talk about this. And I get to talk about it before it's even over. So I paused it. I was like, all right, tell me all your questions. And she said, what genre would you say this movie is? I said, I would call it action adventure. And she said, do you think this movie knows that it's funny? I said, oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
This movie absolutely. And she's like, oh, okay. So I feel like she thought, like, am I laughing at the director or am I laughing with the director?
And I think that is a disconnect. I think some people don't. It's a very self-aware movie. And I'm going to get into some discussion about how much I appreciate the self-awareness and some examples of it. But I think that's part of the issue is like it's a little ambitious in the way that it's presenting its main character, and I don't think people understand that maybe out the gate.
Okay, I'm going to play a clip from an interview that Carpenter did. The quality of the sound is not great. He's explaining that the studio thought it was getting an Indiana Jones type movie. And this is what he says about that.
They'd seen all the dailies. They watched everything that I shot. I cut it together and showed it to them, and they had never realized it was a comedy. Or maybe that wasn't it exactly. They didn't realize it was this kind of comedy. They were worried that the white guy was too stupid. That all the Asians were better than him. I said, yes, the point. That's what the movie's about. It's about this idiot, you know, stumbles into a world he doesn't understand, staggers through it, does absolutely nothing, and thinks he's done everything and staggers away into the night. That's the film.
So, to me, this is a fascinating approach. And given the context, is this movie a parody of Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yeah, I think it's a parody of all white savior action movies and movies in general. In fact, the beginning of the movie is so the part where Egg Shen is, you know, relaying the story, and he's like, "Leave Jack Burton alone," right? That was added on after the fact because the studio is like, he's not enough of a hero. So they had to create this moment where he was revered by the community as a hero.
Interesting.
And so it still kind of works. In fact,
so you have in a movie that's critiquing the white savior, you've added a white savior prologue to kind of make it more palatable to a wider audience.
But here's what I think, in a way, and I don't know if Carpenter meant to do this or not, but when I rewatched that, because at first it sort of didn't jive with me. But then I'm like, oh, I kind of like this now, because I think it almost feels like this is how, you know, almost how unreliable almost all hero narratives maybe are. Like, we get the sense, we get this introduction, like, oh, Jack Burton, you know, you don't even know about how Jack Burton. And then we see the story, and we're like, he didn't do anything. You know, I mean, he does kill Lopan. So, I mean, there is that element, right? So, like, so that's kind of, like, I think it's kind of an interesting way that maybe the idea of lore can exist. It's like, Jack Burton misses with the knife because he's got great reflexes when it comes to, like, you know, bottles getting hit in his face. He can get the knife again and go really fast. So, like, that's a neat trick that happened to work out in a scenario where nothing else was working out for him.
Well, the one thing that he's got going for him, and I mean it, this is the only thing he's got going for him, is he's got amazing reflexes.
Exactly. Exactly. It's all in the reflexes. So when it's all said and done, who killed this larger-than-life big boss figure? It was Jack Burton. So it's kind of like, yada, 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 Jack Burton saved the day.
Uh-huh.
So that almost works, like this idea of, like, leave Jack Burton alone. Like, it's almost an apologetic for Jack Burton, as opposed to, I read it as an apologetic as opposed to, oh, he's this really great hero. It's kind of like, hey, leave him alone. We are a little bit in debt to him, but at the same time, you know, totally could have done this without him.
That's really interesting.
So I love the idea that, and that's how much, when I keep watching this movie, I'm like, Jack Burton is just all talk. And I love that Kurt Russell, because I was thinking my mom and some other people, like, oh, he's just doing like a bad John Wayne. I'm like, that's the point. He's critiquing that hero. Like, it's actually a fascinating critique in a time, especially, and we've talked about this with the 80s movies and, you know, in a movie rife with kind of on the surface tropey, you know, Chinese mysticism, it could feel like just another one of those sort of just a diminishing of a culture in the 80s would do that with Asian culture all the time. But Carpenter brings in Chinese filmmakers to consult. He wanted to make a martial arts movie, and it's okay that there happens to be mysticism. And that's probably why, like, the studio signs off on it, because they're like, okay, cool, you're making one of these. And he's like, not really. Like, I mean, not really making that. And then, of course, it's racing to the theaters for release, knowing that The Golden Child is in the work. And The Golden Child has got Eddie Murphy, who's king of the world. And there's, at least on the surface, similar themes. And then you want to talk about tropey. Like, that's one. Like, you look at them side by side, and one almost would feel like it's a parody of the other, right? Eddie Murphy, of course, not the white savior, but he is the American savior, right?
So that's interesting. I had never thought about those two in relationship to each other. Clearly, they have a lot in common. But it almost feels like Golden Child is the movie that took all the studio notes.
Right. Totally.
And it was like, 100%. No, this is exactly the kind of movie that we want. This is an action adventure that allows us to dip into, you know, Eastern exoticism. But the main character's competent and funny, and he wins in the end. And because that movie took all of those notes, it's a worse movie because of it.
Totally.
Huh.
Now, granted, it did better at the box office than this one.
Like, yeah, this one was a disappointment at the box office.
But legacy wise, no one's talking about Golden Child like they're talking about Big Trouble.
No. This is a cult classic. So just a shout out to David from the Lorehounds, who created a Notion page for this season of Properly Howard. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. One of the things that I learned from the show notes, this movie made about half of the budget. So that's pretty much a flop at the box office. Probably because most of the people were walking out and had the opinion of your mother.
Totally.
And didn't quite see in the movie what you saw in the movie. Now, when you were, 11 years old, I'm guessing that you didn't know to critique the white savior.
No. But so I liked the idea. I love the idea that the hero was funny and that he wasn't very good. And I didn't really know why necessarily. Like, I wasn't putting it together like, oh, this is a wonderful critique on the blah, 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 blah. But I was just like, it was funny when it was supposed to be. It was cool looking when it was supposed to be. Jack Burton is fascinating. Like, Jack Burton is.
Is that this, true? Is this true?
Yes. Because he's Jack Burton is like maybe the first hero that gives off I only get every other weekend with my kids energy.
I'll play a little clip from good old Jack here.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there. It's a pretty amazing planet we live on here. And a man would have to be some kind of fool to think we're all alone in this universe.
Takes a big bite of his sandwich.
Love it. Oh, my gosh.
Little bit of a theologian, this guy. Oh,
I mean, it's just, he's a blowhard out the gate, right? I mean, and he's just... I can't quote this movie enough. I mean, anytime somebody puts up a glass, I go, may the wings of liberty never lose a feather.
It's funny because yesterday, my daughter and her girlfriend were like, let's memorize that because that's the one we're going to repeat often.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the questions that we ask sometimes is, who's this movie for? Interesting that this movie was for 11-year-old you. Because it can be enjoyed on one level. And it can also be for 48-year-old you. Because you can enjoy it on an entirely different level.
Oh, yeah. And I as you know, our listener knows, I am prone to advocating for maybe that which is not logically advocated for. But this is a cult classic. For a lot of reasons.
Yeah. You could even almost like say, give this as the textbook example of a cult classic.
Totally. And I've said before, it's like, I feel like nobody makes a cult classic out the gate quite like John Carpenter, which leads me to you know, want to talk more about Carpenter and just the idea that it's like, is he a visionary? Is he somebody who is is he one of those comics that like is kind of like the joke, you'll get the joke later. You know what I mean? Like, there's something about what he creates and how often, like, I mean, he's made some stinkers, no question. And we'll get to one later this season. But like, a movie like The Thing, I mean, that is just completely disregarded and in many cases hated, and then now is kind of used as this sort of, you know, benchmark for horror, right? Mm-hmm. It's like... Mm-hmm. But that doesn't. The movie didn't change. Our perception of it did. And
well, so it could be that he's making movies for himself, and I think that that sort of is the auteur director. That's sort of the ideal. Mm-hmm. Are you making this movie because you think other people will like it or spend money on it, or is it something deep down inside that you are interested in? Because if that's the case, if you're writing it for yourself, then like-minded people might enjoy the experience as much as you did. And maybe that's good enough. You know, maybe that's the only way to make movies, or maybe that's the only way to create content. But maybe it's not the way to get rich, you know?
Right. Right. And he's lost some, so he had lost some major contracts because of that. You know, I mean, The Thing sort of derailed. I mean, because Halloween was such a hit and all that. And like, he was supposed to make some other big studio films. And he looks back and says, you know, it was unfortunate that these things happened. You know, they didn't get to do Firestarter and he didn't get to do some other things. But also says, if I don't get that rejection, I don't make Big Trouble in Little China, which I think is fascinating to say because it was a bomb. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I remember seeing it and hearing that everybody didn't like it and it didn't do well, and I was just like, am I crazy? I mean, I'm like, this is awesome. And so I kept watching it. So I've been watching it forever. Heather is very patient with my appreciation for this movie. Because even if I explain to her all this, it's, you know, she's like, mm-hmm. It's just not her bag.
Yeah. Okay.
Or not her six demon bag, as
I want to talk about naming in this film. All right. First off, Big Trouble in Chinatown? No. Mm-mm. Big Trouble in Little China. Now, if you go to other cities in the U.S., maybe they do call Chinatown Little China. Not in San Francisco.
No.
So in the film itself uses the term Chinatown, right?
Right.
But the title of the film is, I guess, going for the asymmetry between big and little, I guess.
Right.
Okay. All right. So
it's a mouthful of a name too, right? I mean, as far as the title.
It is. And I was actually going to call that out as this season progresses. Listen to the first few titles that we're covering. She's Having a Baby. Big Trouble in Little China. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Buffy the Vampire Slayer. No Country for Old Men. These are all like 5 or 6 word titles.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and I know we take a couple of breaks, but then we get back to like Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
All right, I want to talk about the names in this movie. Jack Burton.
Beautiful.
It says everything you want to know about this character.
He's so impossibly white. Jack, if you told me that every single linebacker for the Green Bay Packers in like the 1940s was named Jack Burton, I'd believe
you. All right. Gracie Law.
Love it.
She's a lawyer, right?
Yeah, she's a spitfire.
She's a lawyer who's sort of a bleeding heart from Berkeley. Her name has both grace and law in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is this sort of like an almost theological commentary on... I don't know what to do with this. I don't know. All right. Here are some other names mentioned. Wang Chi. This is maybe the real hero of the movie.
Right? Oh, yeah. He's sure the hero.
So Jack Burton is basically a sidekick, right?
And that's a Carpenter calls this out specifically. He says this movie is about a sidekick who doesn't know he's the sidekick.
Right. Okay. Sure.
And I think that's great. And when you watch it through that lens, it's kind of fascinating because it feels like there was a different movie that you could be watching, and Jack Burton is the comic relief. In this movie, he's the star, and he's also the comic relief.
Okay. This is the name that gets me, David Lopan.
I love David Lopan. David. Okay.
David is over 2,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He's more dream than man at this point. He's got, you know, connections in the demon underworld. He's kind of the big baddie. His name is David.
Yeah, I love it.
what are we doing?
I know, which is kind of crazy, right? Because if you do want to continue on like to some sort of like biblical concept, right? I mean, well, David is not the giant; he's, you know, he's quite the opposite. Happening? But everything's big. It's big. He's big trouble in Little China, you know.
His nemesis in Chinatown is named Egg.
Yes.
So that's there's a few other folks. You got Thunder, Rain, and Lightning.
Mm-hmm.
You've got someone named Needles in this cast. Someone named One Ear. So with someone named Joe Lucky, these names are they more self aware than they ought to be, or are they less self aware than they ought to be?
I think that this movie is so intentional, you know, and
why name this guy David? I don't understand.
I think it's great. David Lopan. I know it gets, because I often forget that his name is David, because I know Lopan, and then they're like, oh, that's David Lopan. But I think I got the sense that the David Lopan is sort of the, that's the name he adopts to sort of fit in.
This is his assimilation.
Like that he's Lopan, but he takes on David Lopan.
So, all right, I want to talk about Lopan a lot.
All drop right. the Steen from the last name.
All right, so here's Lopan explaining his motivations.
This place is my tomb. I'm buried here. A young man, a king, a warrior, is entombed in this old man's crippled body. And all I need is a woman, Mr. Burton. A special kind of woman with dragon green eyes to make me whole again. Young again, that I may rule the universe from beyond this grave.
Qing Dai, the god of the east.
Who, him? This guy?
No, not me, Mr. Burton. If it comes hunger, my demon, the god I must appease in order to regain my heart, my blood. A girl with green eyes to satisfy Qing Dai. A girl brave enough to embrace the naked blade. And when I find her, I will marry her.
Never!
And Qing Dai will be happy and my curse will be lifted.
Go off and rule the universe from beyond the grave.
Indeed!
Or check into a psycho war, whichever comes first, huh?
Jack, will you...
Jack, what? I'm supposed to buy this shit? 2,000 years and he can't find one broad to fit the bill? Come on, Dave. You must be doing something seriously wrong.
There have been others, to be sure. There are always others, are there not? You seem to be one who know the difficulties between men and women. How seldom it works out. Yeah. Try by fools.
So
I love right. that exchange because to me that's a laugh out loud funny scene because all it's right. like because he's giving all this exposition, right? And which is, you know, a wonderful trope to talk about all this, you know, this universe. And then, you know, Wang gets it. This is firing him up because he's like, This is the battle I'm going up against. And Burton, meanwhile, is just like, you gotta find another broad. Come on. and then it breaks him down and he starts like going like, you understand how hard it is to find. I love that sequence.
All right. Tons of questions. Tons of questions.
By the way, I just read something that said that Lopan uses the modern alias David Lopan when he's disguised as a crippled old man in the wheelchair as the head of the trading company called the Wing Kong Exchange. So that's how he's undercover. He's Lopan, but in order to make people not think that he's the Lopan, he throws a David in front of him. Kind of like how Obi-Wan Kenobi became Ben Kenobi and nobody knew what was up.
I like it. Okay. All right. That's helpful. All right. I've got other questions about David Lopan. In this universe that they're living in, is having green eyes the equivalent to like having six fingers on your right hand or something?
Yeah, I assume so.
Like in this world, no one's got green eyes.
Yeah, and these are pretty green eyes too. If you look at their eyes, like Miao Yin and Gracie Law, their eyes are like jade green, right? Like they're like green. So my assumption is that it's this particular green is what we're talking about, not just all right. green eyes.
All right. So, yeah. So the green eyes. Green-eyed
lady.
But there have been others.
Oh, there have been others. But they could not bear the naked sword.
It just didn't work out between, you know how it is between men and women.
I love that. I mean, that sequence is... the only time that like Jack does anything is he just makes people frustrated. He can't take the safety off a gun.
You know how it is when you meet a girl with green eyes and you think she's going to bring you back to mortality, but she can't really hold on to the flaming blade.
She can't hold on to the blade, and then it's just kind of nag, nag, nag.
Thought it was going to work out. It just didn't work out. All right, so... Green eyes is very rare in this world, it seems. But he's able to find not one, but two women with green eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he's got to think, this is it. This is going to happen.
Well, that's what he even says. He says, I'm going to sacrifice one and have my earthly pleasures with the other.
Okay. All right. So that's what he wants out of life. Now, when James Hong was interviewed about this, he tries to explain the dilemma.
The most feared figure in Chinese legend, David Lo Pan.
The 2,000-year-old man. That's the David Lo Pan that has traveled through the history of China over 2,000 years, looking for this girl with the green eyes, you know, and just keep looking, and he's looking constantly for... It gets kind of tired after 2,000 years.
He's just sort of over it.
He's been looking and looking 2,000 years. Gets so tired.
James Hong rules.
And he's trying to explain to this interviewer how his character is motivated. You know. 2,000 years. That's a long time to be looking for a girl with green eyes. You could become a supervillain looking that long. All right. I want to talk about Al Leong because he, of course, brought us to this beautiful film. Not a huge part in this.
No.
Very memorable, though.
Yeah, yeah. Shows up a couple times. Does he speak? I don't remember.
I was wondering if he even had a line.
Yeah.
I mean, he certainly has a particular look.
Is there, I mean, it's so funny because in She's Having a Baby, you know, he speaks and he has all, and I'm like, and I know he talks in a little in Lethal Weapon, and it's just funny how, like, he is such a recognizable actor from the 80s. That most people probably don't know what he sounds like.
It's almost like the look says that says it all. If you were going to have a character who's bald on top and has a long flowing mane in the back, that says villain immediately, right?
Right.
You don't even have to say anything.
And that was what was fun to see him as the photographer, like just not playing a villain role.
All right, a couple lines that got big laughs from my living room last night. Son of a bitch must pay.
Oh, I love that line.
That got a big one.
It's the delivery in which he does, son of a bitch must pay. It's like, it's so... that John Wayne cadence that is, it's just mocking too. I love it.
Call the president was great.
Yeah, that, okay, that you was, people okay. Sit tight, hold the fort, keep the home fires burning. And if we're not back by dawn, call the president.
odd sort of distortion in my particular viewing experience. I was so distracted by the long pinky nails on Lo Pan.
Even when he uses them as a like a video game controller.
Well, even before that, he walks into the room with
Miao Yin.
Yeah, Miao Yin. And she's floating. She's mm-hmm. She's not on a table. She's floating above, you know, it's 5 feet above the floor. I did not notice that she was floating. I was focused so much on the long fingernails that I missed the fact that she was floating. And then the next time I went to that scene, I said, is she floating? And my wife said, she's been floating the whole time. I guess I missed that. I was focused elsewhere. But of course, yeah, the fingernails become part of his sort of natural weaponry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love when they have their like little avatars fighting. Like that's their little battle.
Well, and he's almost using his thumbs like a remote control.
Yeah, yeah, he's gaming, and then they even kind of like. Make a reference to it, like you're just like he's like you never could beat me. Like I love that idea that like what I want more about that. You know, I want to know like were these battles or were these like were they not? Were they like you know maybe
yeah?
Maybe
well, when...
a story that they were friends and they would do this little little game. I don't know, man. It's wild.
When Lo Pan mentions to I think it was Thunder and Rain or Rain and Lightning or whatever when he mentions Egg's name to them. You kind of get a look, just a brief look of fear on their face. Like, oh, yeah, yeah. Great. eggs here. Maybe we've met our match or something.
Egg is great, by the way. I love when he gets all the potion.
Time for the medicine. Cheers!
This does what again exactly?
Huge buzz.
I just think it's so, and like some of the lines where he's above and like trying to get him out of like the pit or whatever, and he's like, how'd you get up there? Wasn't easy.
Why does
that's it?
All right, so I don't know how deep I want to dive into the psyche of Jack Burton here, but he's hell bent on getting together with Gracie Law at the beginning. He risks his life to save her. They get away. They vanquish the villain. And then he's out?
He's out.
She even suggests she go on the road with him. Like, he gets to live his life with Gracie Law hanging out in the cab of his truck. And he just bolts. And I'm wondering, like, does he become like self-aware at that point? Like, maybe I'm not the best guy for her, or is he like, what is his motivation at this point?
Yeah. It's hard to know if he's not just dumb. Right. which I think adds to it, because it's like, there's this, like, he's really not that complex, you know? And so there is this idea.
But if he's trying to get her in the sack, I think that's on offer at this point.
Right, but she's kind of coming on like, oh, we'll go together and we'll just be a thing. And I don't think that's what he's... Look, he's a pretty reasonable guy.
Normally guys like that realize that after the sack.
He's a pretty reasonable guy. He's just seen some pretty unreasonable things.
I mean, in one interpretation would be that he's actually has a little moment of clarity. He's like... Actually, I can see where this is going to go. Most people end up being kind of annoyed by me in the end.
Well, he says that specifically, right? So sooner or later, I rub people the wrong way.
Sooner or later, he rubs people the wrong way, and he's just trying to head that off at the pass. I don't get the sense that he's usually the kind of guy to head that off at the pass.
Fair.
My feeling is that he usually is just like Jack Burton wherever he goes, and if that rubs you the wrong way, so be it.
It could be that he actually has feelings for her, and...
Oh, he's scared of commitment.
And it's like, look, I'm going to rub you the wrong way, and that would hurt too much, because I know what I am.
Interesting.
What does she say? She's like, see you around, Jack. He's, never can tell.
Never can tell, and then the question is posed... Aren't you even going to kiss her goodbye? Just a nope. He just nopes out.
Nope. Yeah. I think that's pretty great. I do think there may be an element of the, if I kiss her, I'm going to want to be with her.
I mean, I guess on a meta level, this is just one more way that Carpenter is sort of subverting the expectation.
Sure. Yes. Yes. I think that could be true. As well,
this guy is not a hero. Don't view him as a hero. He doesn't get the girl at the end. He's as stupid as he was at the beginning. And let's just keep the Pork Chop Express rolling along.
Yeah, if you're trying to make the point that this guy is not the hero of this film, he cannot get the girl, because that's what the hero does.
So I like that a lot. I don't know in the world if that makes the most sense for this particular character.
That's fair, but it may not make most sense in the world for the one guy to just inflate himself to death.
That was the one moment when my daughter said, that seemed a little racist.
That seemed racist.
So I don't know whether it was sort of the cartoonish face on the guy as he was expanding.
Gotcha.
That got her, or whether she just doesn't like the idea of people exploding.
Well, and I think it is, and I'm actually really glad to hear that your daughter watched this, because I do wonder, because there is like we talk about this with especially the Asian stereotypes in the 80s, and how frequently just the tropiest of tropes would be used. Mm-hmm. And so I think there would be an inclination for our generation to be more forgiving in some cases. Like, different time, let's just watch it. And then I think there's another inclination for a younger generation to be like, I can't imagine that this is going to be handled with a deft hand. And just because John Carpenter sets out to make a martial arts movie and he gets the consultation of filmmakers from China and is seeking out to sort of disrupt some of these narratives doesn't mean that he's completely immune to falling into some sort of tropes or whatever because of the time being different. It'd be hard to expect him to be 2025 progressive in 1986, right? It's just, that's not super reasonable.
And, you know, we've talked a little theology already on this podcast, but I do make this point a lot with my students. I say, look, Paul the Apostle was probably considered a pretty progressive guy in 30 Year of Our Lord, right? So it's a, you know, you can't expect John Carpenter to have the sensibilities that we have now, but kind of ahead of its time.
That's why I do pretty think impressive. He deserves a lot of credit for taking a movie in that time frame that could easily be that. And I think, and so for your daughter to say that felt, it could also be that there is an element of like, there's no way that this isn't somehow going to have some racism in it, right?
Well,
like, just given the time and all of
sure,
that.
Sure. And I will say that, you know, everyone in the living room last night laughed a lot. We all enjoyed the film. You know, there was that tiny little moment, which if it was racist, I'm sure it was unintentional. And I do think that brings us to a conversation about special effects in this film. Very Jim Henson-esque. I almost was wondering, like, did they get Henson
to create for, like, some of the creatures?
Yeah, for the creatures specifically, because there's certainly, certainly they're practical effects, right? And then, but they seem like they've been puppeteered in the way that Henson would puppeteer, like, you know, Dark Crystal.
I think it's probably a pretty, there's a lot of popular puppeteering type work. How did you feel about the effects? Did you feel like they were
the right level of effects for this movie?
Yeah, I tend to agree. Practical effects go a long way, even if they are a little puppety, but I think none of the creatures felt gruesome.
The most gruesome part of this entire film was when they went underneath the water part of the dungeon and there were all those dead bodies decaying underwater. Right. I might even delete that because it set an expectation for the level of horror that you were going to get throughout, but really it just gets more comical throughout.
Well, yeah. And I think, and that's an interesting time for the '80s too, is because I think, trying to manage ratings and like expectations and like maybe a certain level of horror or, you know, a little more gore or something would add some sort of like maturity to a film to maybe almost give the illusion of some, a little more gravity maybe. I don't know. It's an interesting time of managing effects. And like, it's like we talk about this with like Howard the Duck, like the classic, like who is that for? Right. Because there's like, okay, well there's action and then there's these like kind of big, you know, explosions. And then there's like these kind of horrific creatures that are, but kind of played up a little bit silly, but it's also like trying to take itself seriously, at least in terms of the danger. And so like the 80s feel like there's a lot of times they're still trying to figure out tone. And I think Ghostbusters is one of those examples. Like we talked about this in the past of like where I just think it's almost perfect in terms of how it executes a really big concept and delivers while still being very funny, but moving a high concept narrative forward. Ghostbusters pulls off a lot of tricks, even if the special effects don't necessarily hold up in some cases, like the stop motion and whatnot. And that's why I think it's really nice about this with all, I think with the puppetry element, it's like, ooh, that's weird. You know, like, so they're weird and it creates a fantastical world. But it matches the tone better, I think. And like, I think you're right about the Kane bodies. It's tonally, it's a bit of a shift. Whereas even the creature that's covered in eyes is like kind of gross, but like funny gross to look at.
Exactly. So I feel like knowing that the prologue with the lawyer was sort of an afterthought helps me a little bit with this, because I feel like if you have a couple big laughs before you do any special effects at all, I feel like what you've told the audience is this is a movie, this is a particular kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're laughing with us, you're kind of in for the ride. And maybe the special effects aren't going to like gross you out as much as they're going to sort of enhance the comedic elements of this movie. But then you append that, you put that prologue on there. You actually do have a little bit of like a lightning in the fingers effect, which I didn't feel like was meant to be funny, but everyone in my family laughed at it.
Gotcha.
I don't know if that, I would have rather had it where like you start with him in the truck and you get progressively weirder as it goes along.
Okay. So you, all right.
So, and then I wanted to ask you about the lawyer scene in general. Why is Egg need a lawyer?
What? Well, there's been fallout, right? Like, there's obviously been explosions and there's been damage done to places. I mean, at one point, a brothel has basically the roof ripped off of it. There's some level of investigation that needs to be taken place. Now, I know San Francisco
All right, so Egg is taken the fall for the destruction of Chinatown.
Well, they saw his tour bus.
Okay.
Leaving these places. And so, yeah, we get the idea that there has to be some sort of like Avengers like fallout, right?
This is the Segovia prequel.
maybe what we're led to believe is that the big trouble in Little China is just the litigation. I kind of like it because I think it, I mean, knowing that it was added to try to pump up the idea of Jack Burton is a little unfortunate on one hand, right? Because it is a concession that's made from the studio. But I don't think, and again, as somebody who watches it a bunch and now understands that level, I used to have some issues with it. I'm like, well, it's talking about him like he's a really big hero, but he's clearly not. And I even before I read that about the adding of the from the studio part, I reconciled it with just the idea, like I said, the idea of lore, kind of taking on its own life, and it could be a variety of things, right? I mean, Jack's gone, so Egg could be like, look, I'll advocate for Jack, but Jack's not really the problem, and maybe bringing him up at all is a good distraction from everything else that's going on. But the for him to show the magic, I think, is interesting, right? I mean, it's almost a way to tell the lawyer, like, look, man, this is above your pay grade. This can't be explained without magic. And also it kind of serves as I don't know how much you really want to go toe-to-toe with me right now.
Well, it does. For sure. You have a new respect for Egg.
Right.
Was there a trope, a cliche, or a device that you enjoyed in this movie?
Jack Burton. I mean, Jack Burton is...
He is all cliche.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's what I love. Because
what if we built the character out of the cliche?
It makes it almost hard to enjoy action heroes after watching this. Because, I mean, especially the John Wayne boys. I think it's so key because it's like now it really feels like, and if you really want to go even further, I mean, John Wayne played Genghis Khan. There's an insensitivity towards Asian culture from Hollywood that goes back that far. So there's something kind of like poetic about this, you know, deconstruction of the white savior narrative in a Chinese environment, and a John Wayne character is the butt of the joke. I think is it's very rich, and I don't want to go so far as to say this movie's important, but I do think it's an outlier in a time that really, you know, makes sense why it would fail.
Was there a tweak that you'd make to this movie to improve it?
A sequel.
Funny that there was never a sequel to this.
Well, I couldn't, right? I mean, there's no, the bombed so hard. And I know that there's been lots of talks about a remake. And this is another one of those ones that's like, good luck. It's one thing if you remake like a popular movie, like we've seen RoboCop remakes. We've seen, Total Recall or, you know, Footloose and all these things that are very popular and beloved. And typically the remakes do not do nearly as well. And part of it is probably just, you know, people either hold onto the source material or they don't. It was for a time, right? Mm-hmm. And this is one, when you start dealing with like cult classics, I think it's even harder to do a remake because it's like, I don't think you get why we like this. And if you're going to remake it, you almost have to remake the cult quality of it to have it have the success. And if you don't, then you've kind of missed the point.
So I think that you could do like some kind of long form, like Netflix series, 8 episodes in the world, not to retell this story.
Right.
But some kind of story that lives in this world.
Almost like Alfred Hitchcock Presents, but it's Jack Burton Presents. And like he talks about things that happen and, you know, like he's just narrating like a crypt keeper type role or something.
I was pretty surprised that this, you know, clearly they filmed at least a couple scenes in Chinatown.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as they pull into the alley, it's clearly it's on the lot in Hollywood. But I was kind of amazed that Chinatown kind of looks the same now as it did in 86. Yeah.
Did you notice there was also a New York setting?
No.
They're in the Ghostbusters fire station when he's making his magic potion.
That interesting. Huh.
They slide down a pole to get down into the
nice. Oh, that's great. So my trope that I like is I like it when you walk into a room full of statues and you know, well, eventually all those
they're going to go down like dominoes.
Yeah. 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 Dude, that's the first thing I thought of when I saw all those statues lined up. I like that. I think for tweak, I mean, maybe now that I know about the first scene, I might want to tweak that.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. Like, yeah. And I don't know how you, I mean, can you just open with Jack in the truck? Does that do enough or do you, and maybe.
I think so.
I think you can. I think it feels like it's built that way, right?
I mean, if you want to make sure that he is not seen as the hero, then he should not be referenced at all in that first scene. It should just be Wang Chi at home or, you know, tell me something about his life
right
before Jack rolls into town.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I love it because, like, I love that we introduce Jack as he's, like, you know, wisecracking truck driver. He's gambling. You know, I love how even when he goes undercover as Henry Swanson, you know, he's like,
oh, I need to claim something. So Henry Swanson, that's his interpretation of a nerd.
Yeah.
The glasses that he's wearing are the glasses I wear on my face every day.
Did you know that one time for Halloween, I went as Jack Burton as Henry Swanson?
Very, very nice. All right.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust. Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust, Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
All right. Is this movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard film?
Because it's John Carpenter and it is so properly Carpenter, that it's really hard to, I would say that because of all this, I would say it's a Howard plus two. And I think the reason why is just because I just don't know. I think again, it's hard to say for a movie that I like so much. I think Ron Howard would have tried to make it better and that would have made it worse.
I could see that. And I could see how you wouldn't want anyone else to make this film, right?
Because it has to be made this way. Because if the story isn't just the story.
Yeah.
It's the manner in which the story is told. And I think that that's a key reason why I think people have a hard time with this movie is because they look at the story only. And it's like, well, it's not, it's the presentation of this story and how, I mean, it's interesting critique and commentary. And all of that is done in a way that's like, but never loses the humor and the charm, which is that it's a pretty big feat, I think, that it pulls off.
So I don't, this, you know, this podcast doesn't often besmirch Ron Howard. We don't revere Ron Howard. Ron Howard makes properly rated movies in general. I don't know if Ron Howard has a distinctive style to his movie making in the way that Carpenter does. So like, if you were going to like, what's the quintessential Ron Howard movie? You could probably name four or five that have varying tonality. Whereas Carpenter, it's like, no, yeah, this is a Carpenter movie. Like you know what to expect going into a Carpenter movie. With that in mind, I think, It's just going to be a better viewing experience.
Right.
So I'm going to say Howard plus three on this one.
Okay.
Do you feel a little bit guilty for not going a little bit higher? I mean, it's among your favorite films and you gave it a Howard plus two.
Yeah, I guess because I do think that Howard could make a fun movie with this. Again, I just don't know about the tone. I mean, you're right. I mean, I could probably just... I think my initial reaction was just to be like, when you start dealing with like, when a movie is so clearly a Carpenter-esque joint, it's hard. Like, it just feels like it's just Ron Howard N.A., you know?
Well, I think that what we're doing is we're calling attention to how meaningless our rating system is.
100%.
That one of Steve's favorite movies, like one of the most rewatched movies in Steve's house. Got a Howard Plus too. And and if you want to try to make sense of that, you're going to be chasing your own tail.
That's right.
All right, I'm going to bring up a new category just for this season, Steve.
Okay.
Which Kevin Bacon character, and you can grab a character from any film, which one of these characters makes the most sense for this film? You're going to add a, if you were going to add a Bacon character from any of his films to this film, which one would you add?
Well, that's a great question. I like to be put on the spot like that. I think you put in probably Tremors' character. I feel like... All right.
And what role would he play in this film?
Now, is he replacing or is he
adding? No, you're just adding.
I feel like the Tremors character could be valuable in a scene that's not in there, like maybe to give some sort of a weapon or you know, some sort of advice, you know, because he's just a regular guy dealing with some unnatural things, right? So like there's something, it seems like that would fit alongside a Burton back and forth.
Interesting.
Give me one. I mean, or any one of the pedophile characters. How about you? What are you going to put in?
So my choice would be bring in Smiling Jack Ross from A Few Good Men. Mm. He's a lawyer. All right. this would be after he left the JAG. Post-military life. He's the lawyer. You put him in the prologue scene.
Oh, I like that.
Steve, is there a half the battle won the ground moment in this film?
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty. I think ultimately it just comes down to trusting your reflexes.
I was going to say, if you're supernaturally struck blind, you can cure it with just a little bit of puddle water.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. I do like a scene I think is underrated is when they're walking out in the rain and like Jack Burton's like working to get under the umbrella, which I think is kind of a real nice subtle way to show that, you know, you don't want to get wet. And then so Wang Chi says, a brave man likes the feel of nature on his face, Jack. And Egg Shen goes, yeah, the wise man has enough sense to get in out of the rain. I love that. I like those little back and forths, right? I mean, and that kind of helps to me put the emphasis back on like, it kind of like almost like a little nod to the fact this is the real, these are the heroes here talking. And Jack is following along trying to get under the umbrella. And I think that's really kind of a nice little subtle way of kind of like reminding the power of the dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much more that we could say.
I'm very pleased that you enjoyed this, because obviously this is a movie that means a lot to me, and I really enjoy it. So it makes me happy to know that Big Trouble in Little China brought a family together.
Brought us together.
It tore mine apart.
It did bring us together. I do think I'm going to be watching this again today because my son fell asleep. And I just don't want him. I don't want him to make the same mistakes that I made. You know, living my life thinking that I had seen this movie, in reality, I'd only seen bits and pieces of it.
So you think that was a good podcast? I would say that we really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we?
That was another line that got it.
It's so great because it's even followed by no horseshit, Jack. No horseshit. We'll be right back.
in a cocoon of horror.